going on, everybody? Welcome to Expanded Perspectives with me, Reverend Cam Hale. And joining me, as always, the hockey man himself who's been ear-beating me over the playoff season about to start, Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? Yes, I'm here in studio.
I forgot. It's comb over, Kyle Filson.
Comb over. I want to apologize, everybody, for not doing a show last week. It was just, you know, it's Easter week. Things happened. I had family come in.
Yeah, that was kind of a quick thing. Things kind of come together and got in the way real fast.
A close friend of ours, father, passed away. Yep. There was just a lot of things. And then I remember texting you. I'm like, dude, I'm not going to be
able to. I can't make it work.
I don't have the time to do it.
Yeah.
So we took a week off.
Sorry, y'all.
Hope you all had a good Easter.
We got more stuff coming. We're not even talking about it. We got surprises coming we can't even tell you about.
That's right. Yeah, things are going good. The Glimmer Man book is doing well.
Yeah.
In fact, I've got a bunch of new Glimmer Man stories to talk about today.
Hey, and thanks for everybody that's messaged and wanting to get them signed and all that stuff. Well, y'all know how we are. We're supposed to be doing shirts for the last 35 years, and we've not done that yet either. But we're going to get around to it, get it all put together.
I got the order put in. I just ordered another several books to be coming in.
Okay.
So
good.
The people that have been messaging us about getting autographed copies, you'll be getting them pretty quick.
And it feels weird. I know y'all want them signed. It feels weird asking us to sign them. I'm like, dude, it's just me and Kyle.
Well, I know what you're thinking. You're like, wait, you've been still waiting on the publisher? Well, this is what happened. The original order we got, ended up giving them all away to family and friends because everybody now I run into, they want one, right?
Yeah.
And then the funny thing is they want me to sign it. I'm like, Mom.
Yeah,
you don't need me to sign the book.
She, you know, be careful. Your mother may actually be listening.
Yeah, she's going on a cruise.
She's going on a cruise.
So I got to watch Pop Up all next week.
The Pop.
We're going to try to call them turkey.
It's real easy. Just give him some scratch and let him cruise around.
Yeah, but it's
they follow him like he's the Pied Piper of Turkey.
I gotta figure out what to call them in, get them within bow range, but then keep the Yorkshire Terrier from yipping. That thing loves to bark.
That's a problem.
I'm going to cage it up.
That's a problem. Yeah, you have to put it in the bedroom, in your mom and dad's bedroom.
Angel.
Let Pop go cruising around. This is the same man. I probably have told y'all this. When Kyle pulls up, if Pop's out on his scooter, he's forced to wear a helmet now because he can't be trusted. And then he's got some big Ray-Ban aviators that he wears that are mirrored. And multiple times, Kyle will call him like Maverick or Iceman and ask him. And if he's got his helmet on to keep himself safe, Kyle will ask him if he scored any goals because of it's just he's. No wonder your dad probably he loves you, but he probably really hates you, too.
No, I asked him how many MiGs he shot down.
Yeah, that's happened. Yeah. Yeah. Usually I'm glad he can't talk sometimes because he would cuss you so bad right now.
It is a miracle. Like seriously, like, you know, we call him a human carcass. He has literally fallen and hit his head. No lying. 40 times.
Well, did we figure out how long it's been?
Since what?
Since it first happened. Has it been 25 years?
Yeah. Yeah.
So he wasn't supposed to live more than about 16 months after they.
Oh, originally the.
He was supposed to die that night.
Yeah, they told me to say your goodbyes.
Yeah,
here he is 25 years later.
Yeah, the whole thing. And they're like, he ain't going to make it. Because he was talking. Remember when we got there, he was talking just fine.
Yep.
And then in the room, we watched that transformation happen and was like, what is going on?
Yeah, my wife and children have never heard him speak. Only through home videos.
All they got to do is call your brother because he sounds just like
him. Yeah, exactly right.
He just sounds like him. But yeah, they were like, he's not going to make it. And if he ever hit his head, remember, they're like, he'll die. And 37 head hits later, he's driving around smoking cigars on his scooter.
Oh, he's pumped and for my mom to go out of town because he knows.
I'm coming out.
He's going to be able to do whatever
cigars.
He wants.
Yeah, we're going to smoke cigars. I'm coming out there. Speaking of coming out, you don't ever want to come out of your tent like early, right?
I thought you were going to say closet.
No.
I thought you were going down a different path. I don't know where we were headed.
I'm trying to. Okay. Thanks, computer. I hate computers of all kinds. Listen to this story. Took place in 1978. Okay. This is a witness report that Lon had sent me of something strange going down during a Girl Scout camping trip in the hills of Southeast Ohio. O-H-I-O. Yeah, you know how that's because it takes two of y'all to spell this, the name of the state is what I was told. But that's just because I'm not a big sports fan. But the sports fan that told us that in Nashville was not fans of Ohio. I think, weren't they Nebraska fans? I think is what it was.
I think so.
Anyway, it says that that night back in 78, the weather had turned rainy and I had gone to sleep in my tent. Sometime later, I woke up in terror because I was being dragged out feet first.
Hmm.
Yeah, something's got a hold of me. He said he grabbed the sleeping bag and was pulling hard enough that my body was coming out of the tent. And the only reason I wasn't completely taken outside is that my head caught against the tent wall. Said it all happened fast, in the dark, and in the rain. Now, I think we've done another story like this. I remember people getting snatched out of their tents.
Can you imagine the horror of being sound asleep and the next thing you know you're being drugged?
I've read enough of Capstick's books of where they talk about like leopards or lions. That's where my mind instantly goes, right, is a big cat. Of course, here it could have been a bear or something. But usually whenever some animal as those snatches you out of the tent, it's with something that's called their mouth.
Yeah.
So it hurts a little bit. This is by your ankles.
Yeah. Right?
It has grabbed you by the legs and is whipping you, then smacking you around like a hammer.
I wonder if was the guy solo camping?
Well, it's a young lady because it's during the Girl Scout thing.
You're right.
Goes on and said, I
thought it was a chaperone.
So you're already panicking. Yeah. You're already like, oh, yeah. I never got a clear look at whatever had me. Said Patty came out and checked the area, and in the darkness, she found nothing. She made me sleep with the other girls for the rest of the night. The next morning, they found my sleeping bag torn to shreds. So we packed up all the things, and not long after that, we left the area. Years later, nearly four decades after it happened, I learned more of what Patty had apparently seen that morning. She had found huge footprints in the mud and followed them for miles before coming upon the ruined sleeping bag. She didn't tell any of us at the time, but she evidently believed something had been lurking around the camp and that we needed to leave immediately. Looking back on it now, I believe that whatever was out there had been watching me earlier and possibly all of us during the day and then decided that night, I'm going to drag them off. I'm taking them. But because of the rain and the slick ground, that's the only way that I had caught myself against the tent and slipped free. And Jessica was talking about that. So, yeah. So it's one of those, you go camping, you're in the Girl Scout camp, everything's cool. Next thing you know, Bigfoot snatches up, tries to tear you out of your tent, runs off with your sleeping bag, probably a good one, tears up your sleeping bag. Look, I don't mind Bigfoot being out there, but don't tear up my camping gear, right? Bro. I'll leave something on the gift and stump. What do you want? Some Jack's Links? Like, what are you looking for?
What's the muffins? What's the brand of those quilts we have for our sleep system? You remember, is it like Tomahawk or something?
No.
Either top cover, bottom cover.
Yeah, I can't remember.
I can't either.
Is it Seek Outside? I don't remember who made them.
I think that's our tarps.
Might be. Yeah.
I was thinking of that, though, when you were talking about
tear up your top quilt. I would be livid. I've taken that thing. We've had them in Arizona. Look, I've spent a lot of time under that top quilt freezing. I don't want Bigfoot. Now, if he took it to use it, I'd get it. But don't tear up my stuff. I'm not out there.
When you were talking about being terrified in the tent, I instantly go back to my beard rubbing on the inside of mine.
When you scared yourself to death.
Thinking something's breathing near me.
Well, the other part of the story was it was kind of strange because we were legitimately a pretty good ways out. You know, we weren't too crazy, but we were probably like 3 miles into where it was at. You wouldn't expect anything to be out there to hear.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Of him rubbing his face on his top quilt, afraid to wake anybody else up because there was something going to get him.
Well, let's move on to another story here.
Yeah,
since the Glimmerman book come out, I've already been receiving more Glimmerman sightings, so there probably will be a part two in a couple more months or years.
That's what I'm talking about. It did seem to like open the floodgates to a point.
I knew that it would, because once people start hearing it, then they're like, oh yeah, I had a similar experience.
Well, and they can go to the book and read all the different places, like, you know, it's not just only in the woods or it's not just only here.
That's right.
Like people have found it. So they're like, oh, maybe this is what it was.
Yeah. Check this one out. It says in early August of 2016, a property guard patrolling a wooded tract already associated with danger and trespassing encountered something far stranger than any human intruder. What he saw above the ground near an alder grove was not solid flesh, but a humanoid distortion in the air itself.
Uh-oh.
A partially formed figure that seemed to ripple like heat, shimmering, or active camouflage. Now, Ben had been guarding a rural property that had become a magnet for trespassers and squatters, including drug users known for violent behavior. Because of the risk, he carried a rifle during his patrols and regularly moved through the heavy woods surrounding the site. One evening in early August 2016, while making his rounds, he felt a sudden and unusual urge to stop beneath an old cedar tree. He sat down his rifle and day pack and sat against the trunk and closed his eyes.
You ever got those urges before while you're walking?
Yeah.
I got this urge.
Almost immediately, he slipped into an oddly peaceful state. The tension drained right out of him. He later described it as calm, centered, and almost zen-like, with a strong feeling that everything was somehow all right. But that sense of calm did not last. After sitting there for some time, Ben opened his eyes and looked to his right toward a nearby alder grove. Suspended perhaps 15 feet above the ground, he saw what appeared to be a humanoid form. But it was not solid in the normal sense. It looked like rippled air, similar to the cloaking effect seen in the Predator films.
Hey-o!
The outline of a head, neck, and shoulders was discernible, but the rest of the figure seemed to dissolve into distortion and absence, and as though the only part of it was visible in this reality. The moment he focused on it, the emotional atmosphere changed completely. A wave of dread came over him with overwhelming force. It was not ordinary fear. It struck him at the deepest level, leaving him convinced that any moment at all might trigger, or I'm sorry, any movement at all might trigger something dangerous. He sat there frozen, just staring, trying to force some rational control over the moment. He removed his glasses slowly, wiped them on his shirt, and put them back on. The figure remained exactly where it had been. At that point, Ben made a decision. He counted down slightly, silently from 5 to 0, then grabbed his rifle and gear and ran for home as fast as he could. Nothing followed him. Nothing appeared at the house, but the encounter stayed with him. Later, one friend describing the experience through a folkloric lens suggested that Ben may have encountered a forest wight, a guardian, a territorial being attached to the land itself. Others advised that if the entity was tied to the location, he should return with an offering. Ben stayed away from the area for a long time. But then in September of 2016, he went back to the site to photograph the area and leave food and water as an offering. As he approached the cedar tree again, the dread returned, though it was not as crushing as it had been the first time. He did not see the cloaked figure again, but he strongly felt that its presence was still there. When he placed the offering down, the atmosphere shifted. He no longer felt threatened. He spoke aloud, explaining that he was only trying to protect the property and stating clearly that nothing was permitted to follow him home. Around the same period, Ben discovered a strange L-shaped hole in the ground about 75 feet from the cedar. It appeared sharply defined and did not resemble the work of any burrowing animal. On a later return, he found 2 long gashes in the earth near the hole, each roughly 2 feet in length and about the width of a man's foot, as though something had driven a heel or edge deep into the soil and dragged it with force. Now, whether these ground traces are connected to the original sighting remains unknown, but taken together and the visual anomaly, the emotional pressure, and the repeated sense of presence and the subsequent physical irregularities suggest that Ben may have encountered something more than an ordinary misrepresentation in the wilderness. So he doesn't know. He doesn't know if this was like a haunting spirit, like we talked about so many times.
Or fae or any, yeah.
That's what makes the Glimmer Man so special and unique, is it doesn't really fall into one category. It falls into many categories. It could be many things, but I don't know what he saw. But you were just mentioning in the previous story about leaving an offering.
Yeah. I think more and more about that, right? Because here's a peek behind the curtain. Where I go and where my stand is, I leave things for the crows. So when I'm out there, you know, baiting for pigs or whatever, I'll take things and leave them in a certain area for the crows because they always show up for the corn. They're always taking off with it. And sometimes there'll be stuff that they've left there. There'll be looks like a pull tab, or there may be something, you know, that they bring it where they'll bring in and leave stuff there with you. So that's why I always think about it, is like, if I'm going to be anywhere that there's an iffy place that I'm camping, like I'm down for leaving a little offering to the things in the woods, just to be like, hey, I'm just passing through. Don't do anything too crazy.
I don't need any harm to come my way. It's just better to, take a chance.
Look, I'm hedging my bets, right?
Yeah.
I'm just trying to cover this. I've got something here that Lon sent me, and it's rather disturbing because this took place on March 29th of this year. This is the Blanco, Oklahoma Mystery Mauling.
Okay.
The reason I dislike the name Mystery Mauling, right? Says there was a mother was brutally attacked in a remote yard before she could reach the front door of her home when she was seeking where she was seeking work. This is what the witness report says. A disturbing and still unresolved attack in Blanco, Oklahoma has left a local mother fighting for her life while investigators work to determine exactly what kind of animal was responsible. According to family members and local reports, Alicia Maxey arrived at a rural property on the morning of March 29th, 2026, seeking work. Before she could make it to the front door, she heard what was later described as a deep growl. She turned and attempted to run back towards the truck, but something suddenly lunged at her, knocked her to the ground, and began a savage assault. Her sister-in-law, Kat Kelly, later said that Alicia had described the attacker as dog-like, though she did not definitely identify it as a dog. That distinction is important. The wording suggests a resemblance, not certainty, and that uncertainty has remained at the center of the case. Alicia was found unconscious and badly injured by the property owner, who reportedly also was an EMT. She was rushed for emergency treatment and then airlifted to a Tulsa hospital, where she underwent multiple surgeries for severe trauma to her face, arms, and legs. Her husband, Wallace, later said that when he first saw her in intensive care, he broke down in tears because the extent of the wounds were far beyond anything that he had expected from a typical animal attack. The Pittsburgh County Sheriff's Office initially considered the possibility that a dog was responsible. However, because of the extreme nature of the injuries, investigators began working with Oklahoma wildlife authorities to identify the animal through torn clothing and other evidence recovered from the scene. Sheriff Frankie McClendon stated that in 38 years, he had never seen injuries caused by a wild animal to this extent. Authorities reportedly considered a dog, a black bear, or a mountain lion among the possibilities, and DNA testing was initiated on material collected at the scene. At the same time, the attack has created a devastating burden for the family. Alicia was the household breadwinner. Wallace is on dialysis and waiting for a kidney transplant, and the family's vehicle was towed after the incident, leaving them in an even more precarious situation as she faces a long recovery. So, she got mauled by something that she didn't see. Apparently, the wildlife groups there in Oklahoma, they, like, it's not a bear, it's not a cat, you know.
And, right.
And, you know, it's pretty simple. If you look around, by the, there would be tracks. You would think there would be tracks. You would be able to know if it was a cat, if it was this,
yeah,
if it was that.
Right.
It sounds like she was just savaged. But, and now that's also saying, too, that they're going off the idea of the of whatever it is that attacked her being native to Oklahoma. We've done stories about animals being out. We got the gorilla story, the tiger story, all of this stuff.
Right,
so there could have been another animal released up there from Joe Exotic's group. Got a release running around up there. Who knows, right? Or just like we talked years back when we had heard that by the, oh, what am I trying to think of there? Where the Windstar is.
Oh, Thackerville.
Yeah, where we heard the dog man encounter by the turkey hunter there.
Speaking of dog man, it reminds me of that. Remember there was that bizarre murder that happened, like, I think it was by Toller or something, where they thought it was a possible dog man.
Yep.
They had a specialist come in, and he was like, this was not a mountain lion.
I don't think they've ever resolved that either, have they?
No, it's a mysterious.
Because he was attacked standing up. And that's what they were like, bro, he, like, a lot of the attack happened when he was upright.
Yeah, they just found him dead, and he was mauled by something, but they don't know what it was. They know that it wasn't a dog, and they know that it wasn't a cat. So you're like, well, what was
then
it?
Then what was it? What mauled you? Giant raccoon? What got a hold of you?
Speaking of Joe Exotic, I didn't know there was a feline sanctuary up there in Bridgeport.
Yes. I've only seen the sign. I've not been to it, but I've seen the sign.
So it's wild. So I was driving these back roads.
Oh, no. Is it like the one up there by the UFO one, too?
Oh, the one in Aurora? That one's closed down.
Okay.
No, this is not like that. This doesn't look like that. What I mean, this is just looks like a ranch.
Well, you need to ask Clayton about it because that's where he grew up and he talked about going out there as a kid and stuff.
So I'm driving around these back roads taking comp pictures and I come to a stop sign and I look over to my right and they're just basking in the sun as a full grown tiger. I'm like, do what? And then I start looking. I'm like, there's another one.
When you're not expecting giant cats laying around, you're like, wait a minute.
No, I mean, this sucker is 20 yards from the road.
And it's a low fence. He's only behind a 5-strand barbed wire fence.
No, no. It was enclosed. But still, I'm just like, wasn't expecting it to see that. And then I started looking, and then I start, look, there's more animals. There's orcs over there. There's zebras.
Well, they got to feed them.
Yeah. So I didn't even know that was there, though.
So I just want to ask you this. Sure. When you saw it, is it still one of those things when you see one, you're like, man, I forget how big those things really are?
Oh, 100%.
Right? Where you're like, ugh. Because you get so used to seeing them on TV, you're like, what are they, like 6 foot long? And then you see one, you're like, dude, no wonder they just eat whatever they want. How are you going to find? Imagine all you had was a rock tied to the end of a stick back in the day, and that's how you had to defend yourself.
Yeah, so I told my wife about it, and then she looked into it, and she's like, man, we need to go do a tour of that place. They only do it on Saturdays, and they don't allow children.
Yep. Well, yeah.
Only adults. And I'm like, I want to ask them, can I carry a side piece with me?
Yeah, you're going to have one on the side. Yeah, you're going to want to carry a gun.
I need a 10 millimeter with me.
No, you know what I'm saying? Shotgun, just shotgun the whole time.
Well, let's take a break, folks. And when I get back from the break, I'm going to be talking about some strange anomalies associated with organ transplant recipients. Stick with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. As many of you know, podcasting isn't my full-time job. That's right, when I'm not in the studio recording, I'm out running my real estate appraisal business. And in that world, there are times when underwriters and I don't exactly see eye to eye on valuation. Believe me, it happens more than I would like. When that happens, I don't just need opinions. I need clear, defensible explanations. And sometimes, I need help articulating exactly what I'm trying to say. And that's where AI comes in. So what AI do I trust? Well, I use Claude. When underwriters push back on valuation, I need more than just guesswork. I need research. I need structure. I need answers that I can stand behind. Claude doesn't just give me results, it helps me think through complex problems, surfaces research I'd probably never find on my own, and backs it all up with solid citations I can actually show clients. It's like having a research partner that works at machine speeds. Claude's internal and external research capabilities go way deeper than basic web searches. We're talking comprehensive, reliable analysis with real sourcing, turning hours of digging into minutes. I use it all the time when I'm creating or looking for content for the show, like this episode that we're talking about. While looking for organ transplant donors and strange anomalies associated with it, I used Claude to help me find information that I couldn't find on my own. You can connect Claude directly to tools that you already use through MCP connectors like GitHub, Jira, HubSpot, Notion, and Google Workspace. And suddenly, it becomes a command center with context from all of your work. If your job depends on research, accuracy, and being able to explain your conclusions with confidence, Claude is worth a serious look. Claude is the AI for minds that don't stop at good enough. It's the collaborator that actually understands your entire workflow and thinks with you, not just for you. Whether you're debugging code at midnight, creating a podcast, or strategizing your next business move, Claude extends your thinking to tackle the problems that matter. Cowork brings Claude Code's energetic power to your desktop. No terminal required, so anyone can use and have Claude do real work. Point it to a folder on your computer or add connectors like Google Drive and Gmail. Describe what you need, and it handles the rest, like organizing files, building spreadsheets, or drafting reports from scattered notes. Queue up tasks and come back to finished work. Ready to tackle bigger problems? Get started with Claude today at claude.ai/expanded. That's claude.ai/expanded. And check out Claude Pro, which includes access to all of the features mentioned in today's episode. That's claude.ai/expanded.
Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Before we get into these strange and unsettling stories that I'm about to tell you, I want to ground us for just a moment in reality. Today's subject is organ transplants and some of the strange side effects some people have experienced after receiving them. First off, organ transplantation isn't rare. It's not fringe. It's one of the most remarkable and life-saving advances in modern medicine. Every single year, tens of thousands of people receive organ transplants. In the United States alone, that number is typically over 40,000 transplants annually. That includes hearts, lungs, livers, kidneys, and more. And behind every one of those surgeries, there are two stories, one of loss and one of survival. At any given time, there are over 100,000 people on the transplant waiting list in the U.S., waiting, hoping, knowing that the only way they'll survive is if a donor becomes available. And here's the reality that's hard to ignore. Roughly 17 people die every day waiting for an organ transplant. That's not a statistic you hear often, but it's the truth. Now, when it comes to heart transplants specifically, the kind most often associated with these personality-changing stories, they are far more rare. Globally, only about 5,000 to 6,000 heart transplants are performed each year. In the U.S., it's usually around 3,500 to 4,000 annually. So when we talk about cases like the ones in today's episode, we're talking about a very small group of people. A small number of individuals who didn't just survive something extraordinary. They came back from the edge of death with someone else's heart beating inside them. And medically speaking, the success rates are actually very remarkable. About 85 to 90% of heart transplants patients survive the first year. Many go on to live 10, 15, even 20 years or more after surgery. Which means these aren't just brief recoveries. These are long lives lived with another person's organ, another person's biology, another person's heart. And that's where things begin to get complicated. Because while medicine can explain how to move an organ from one body to another, it doesn't fully explain what it feels like to live with that reality. To wake up every day knowing that your life continues because someone else's ended. To feel your heartbeat and know that it didn't start with you. And for most people, that's where the story ends. Survival. Gratitude. Moving forward. But for a small number of recipients, something else happens. Something harder to measure. Harder to explain. Subtle changes. Unexpected feelings. Moments that don't quite line up with who they used to be. And that's where today's stories begin. This first story is crazy. It's not just a story about death. It's a story about what might come after, in a way that feels deeply personal, deeply unsettling, and just grounded enough in reality to make it hard to dismiss. This is the story of Terry Cottle and Sonny Graham. And by the time it's over, you may find yourself questioning something as simple and as mysterious as your own heartbeat. Let's go back to the late 1980s. Arizona. Wide open land, dry air, long stretches of quiet desert where sound carries, and silence feels almost alive. It's the kind of place where, at night, you can hear your own pulse if you pay attention. Somewhere, in that stillness, lived a man named Terry Cottle. Now, Terry wasn't famous. He wasn't someone you would have read about in the news under normal circumstances. He had a life, a routine, people who knew him, people who loved him. But like so many stories that end in tragedy, there were things happening beneath the surface. Things we don't fully understand. Maybe pressures, maybe pain, maybe something internal that never quite found its way into words. And then one day,
Without warning to the outside world, Terry made a decision. He took his own life. A single gunshot. Quick, violent, final. The kind of ending that leaves a ripple effect behind it. Grief that spreads outward, touching everyone connected to that person. For his family, especially his wife Cheryl, it wasn't just a loss. It was shock. Confusion. The kind of grief that comes with questions that never get answered. Why? Could anything have changed it? Was there a moment where things could have gone differently? But in the middle of that darkness, there was one decision Terry had made long before that day. He was an organ donor, and because of that choice, his story didn't end with him. At almost the exact same time, miles away, another man was facing his own ending. His name was Sonny Graham, and Sonny's situation was just as final, only slower. His heart was failing, not metaphorically, not emotionally, physically. Every beat was weaker than the last. Every day was a step closer to the inevitable. Doctors had done what they could, but medicine has its limits, and Sonny was reaching them. Without a transplant, he was going to die. There's a strange kind of waiting that comes with that reality, knowing that your survival depends on something unthinkable. For you to live, someone else has to die. And then it happened. A heart became available, a perfect match. It was Terry Cottle's heart. Think about how thin that line is. Two men, one life ending in a sudden, violent moment. Another life hanging by a thread, just waiting. Somewhere in that space between death and survival, their stories crossed. Surgery was scheduled, doctors moved quickly. Machines, monitors, surgical lights, all of it coming together for a single purpose: to take the heart from one man and place it in another. Hours passed, and then it was done. Sonny Graham survived. A new heart beating in his chest. Terry Cottle's heart. At first, everything followed the path you'd expect. Recovery. Gratitude. A sense of awe at a second chance he'd been given. Imagine waking up every day knowing that your life continues because of someone you've never met. Someone whose final moments you can't fully comprehend. Many transplant recipients feel a sense of curiosity about their donor. But with Sonny, it went beyond that. At first, it was subtle. A passing thought. A quiet wonder. Who was he? What was his life like? But those thoughts, they didn't fade. They only grew. Stronger. More persistent. It wasn't just curiosity anymore. It was a pull. An emotional gravity that didn't quite make sense. Sonny felt connected to this man, this stranger, in a way that he couldn't fully explain. And eventually, that feeling turned into something he couldn't ignore. He needed to know more. So, he began the process of reaching out. It took time. There are rules, privacy barriers, and steps that you have to follow. But eventually, contact was made. Terry Cottle's widow, Cheryl. Now stop for a second. Picture that moment. A woman who lost her husband in a sudden, violent tragedy, being told that somewhere out there is a man who is alive, because her husband is not. A man walking around with her husband's heart beating inside his chest. Still beating. Still alive. They agreed to meet, and this is where things begin to feel different. Not dramatic, not explosive, just off. Like something slightly out of place. When Sonny and Cheryl met face to face, something happened. Something neither of them expected. Sonny would later describe it as immediate. Not just comfort, not just shared understanding, but recognition. As if somehow this wasn't the first time. As if something inside him already knew her. Now, you can explain that in a lot of ways. Grief, relief, the emotional weight of the situation. But even then, there was something about it that didn't quite fit into those explanations. Because they didn't just meet and go their separate ways. They stayed in touch. They talked. They spent time together. And the more time they spent, the stronger the connection became. It wasn't forced. It wasn't awkward. It felt natural, familiar. And before long, it became something more. That's right. They fell in love. Let that settle in. The man who received Terry Cottle's heart fell in love with Terry's wife. And eventually, they got married. If you heard that as fiction, you might call it poetic, or unbelievable, or maybe even unsettling, because it raises a question that's hard to answer. Why her? Out of everyone in the world, why did Sonny feel drawn specifically to Cheryl? Some people say, it's a coincidence. Others say, it's psychological. Two people connected by trauma, finding comfort in each other. But then there's another idea, one that exists just outside the boundaries of accepted science. Something called cellular memory. The theory suggests that organs, especially the heart, might carry more than just biological function. That they might store fragments of who we are, emotions, preferences, even memories. Now, scientifically, there's no solid evidence to support this. Most experts reject it outright. But cases like this, they don't just prove the theory. They just make it harder to completely dismiss them. Because Sonny didn't just fall in love with Cheryl. He felt drawn to her, compelled, as if something inside him recognized something inside her, something that had been there before. Years passed, life moved forward, and on the surface it looked like a second chance, a strange but meaningful continuation of something that had been lost. But beneath the surface, there's a question that lingers. Was everything really as normal as it seemed? Or was there something deeper? Something unseen, quietly influencing the course of events. Because in 2008, the story came full circle. Sonny Graham died. And just like Terry Cottle, he died by suicide. A self-inflicted gunshot wound. The same method, the same ending. Two men, one heart, one story repeating itself. Now maybe that's a coincidence. Maybe it's the weight of knowing where the heart came from. Maybe it's something psychological, something we don't fully understand about identity, trauma, and the human mind. But what if it's not? What if, in some small, unmeasurable way, parts of us don't die when we do? What if something lingers, not as a ghost, not as a spirit, but as something quieter, something physical, something that can be passed on? Beating, steady, carrying with it echoes of a life that ended, but didn't fully let go. And, if that's even remotely possible, then it raises a question that's hard to shake. When you listen to your own heartbeat, is it just keeping you alive? Or is it remembering something? I'll let you think about that, because some stories don't end. They just keep beating. Let's move on. In the late 1980s, a woman named Claire Sylvia was running out of time. Her body was failing her in a way that modern medicine could only slow, not stop. Her heart and lungs were deteriorating, and every breath became a negotiation. Every heartbeat, a reminder that her life had started to shrink down to something fragile and uncertain. For a long time, she lived in that space between hope and inevitability, waiting, watching, knowing that somewhere, somehow, the only thing that could save her would have to come from someone else's ending. And then it happened. A donor was found. A young man had died, and his heart and lungs were offered for transplant. We don't often stop to think about what that really means. One life ending, another being rebuilt from what remains. The surgery was long, complex, the kind of procedure that pushes the limits of what the human body can endure, both one giving and the one receiving. And when it's over, Claire Sylvia survived. She woke up changed in the most literal sense. Her heartbeat was not her own. Her lungs were not her own. But her life continued. At first, everything followed the expected path. Recovery, weakness, gradual rebuilding of strength, the slow and careful process of learning how to exist inside a body that had been interrupted and then reconstructed. Doctors told her what most transplant patients are told: take your medication, listen to your body, and give yourself time. And for a while, that's exactly what she did. But then, something subtle began to shift. It started with hunger. Not normal post-surgery appetite. Not medication cravings. Something more specific. She began to crave things like never before. Foods she once avoided now felt necessary. Not just appealing, but strangely familiar. Chicken nuggets, beer, things she never associated with her previous life suddenly felt like they belonged to her. At first, she dismissed it. The body just adjusting, the mind adapting. But the feeling didn't fade. It deepened. And then came something even more unsettling. Dreams. Not vague dreams, no. Not abstract fragments, but vivid, recurring images of a young man she did not recognize. Someone she'd never met. Someone who did not belong in her memories, but appeared in them anyway. In these dreams, there was a sense of familiarity, not with places she had been, but with places she had never seen. Not with people she knew, but with people she somehow understood. And always, there was a feeling, a presence, a quiet awareness that something was missing, even though she could not name what it was. When she woke up, the feeling stayed with her longer than the dream itself. It was as if part of the dream had followed her back into waking life. Now, most people would interpret this as psychological noise, the brain processing trauma, the emotional aftermath of life-saving surgery, the mind trying to rebuild identity after being physically rebuilt. But Claire, man, she couldn't shake it, because it didn't feel random. It felt directed, intimate, like something inside her was trying to communicate without words. As time passed, the sensations didn't diminish. They became part of her daily awareness. The cravings remained. The dreams continued. And the sense of an unfamiliar second presence inside her life became harder and harder to ignore. Then came the question she couldn't stop asking herself. Who was the person she came from? Eventually, she decided to find out. Through the transplant system, carefully, cautiously, within the limits of privacy, she learned only fragments at first. He was a young man. He was, of course, a donor. A life cut short in an accident. But even those small details changed something inside her. Because suddenly, the feeling she had been experiencing had a direction. A source. A human origin. The cravings. The dreams. The emotional echoes. They all began to feel like they were pointing towards someone real. Someone who existed before her. Eventually, more information surfaced about the donor. His name, his personality, the things he liked, the way he lived. And as Claire learned more, something unsettling began to happen. Pieces began to align. The foods she had begun craving were foods that he had enjoyed. The personality shifts she noticed, subtle changes in mood, in preference, in instinct, seemed to reflect traits described by those that had known him. Even the dreams began to feel less like dreams and more like fragments of a life she had never lived. And that is when the question stopped being abstract and started becoming personal. Was she simply healing in an unusual way? Or was something of him still present inside her? Not metaphorically, but physically. There is a concept, controversial, unproven, and widely rejected in the scientific circles. It's called cellular memory. The idea that organs might carry more than biological function, that they might in somehow, some unknown way, retain traces of the donor's identity, preferences, emotional imprints, even fragments of memory. Most doctors dismiss it completely. They point to psychology, medication, stress, suggestion, and those explanations are reasonable, but they don't always feel complete to the people who experienced these changes firsthand. Claire Sylvia eventually wrote about her experience in her memoir, A Change of Heart. In it, she described not just the physical transformation of receiving a transplant, but the internal shift that followed. A shift that feels less like healing and more like blending. Two lives overlapping in a way that defied simple explanation. Over time, she would reflect on the possibility that she wasn't a possession or a haunting or anything supernatural in the traditional sense, but something quieter, something more intimate. The idea that when a heart is moved from one body to another, something of its history might come along with it. Not a soul, not a ghost, but something less defined. An echo, a pattern, a residue of life that doesn't immediately disappear just because the body stops functioning. And if that were true, even in the smallest possible way, then it changes how we think about identity itself. Because we tend to believe we are contained entirely within our own bodies. That consciousness begins and ends with us. That memory is locked inside the brain like a private archive. But stories like Claire's, even if they are interpreted differently by science and skepticism, still raise a difficult question. What happens when part of someone else becomes part of you? And where exactly does you begin after that? Years later, Claire would remain a central figure in discussions about transplant experiences and the controversial idea of cellular memory. Some dismissed her story entirely. Others saw it as a symbolic story rather than a literal one. And a smaller group saw it as something far more unsettling. Evidence that the body might not be as silent as we assume. That it might carry more than we prepared to understand. Because if identity truly is biological, then replacing a heart shouldn't just save a life, it should simply continue it. But Claire's story suggests something more complicated. Something that doesn't fit neatly into medicine or metaphor. Something that lingers, quietly, in cravings, in dreams, in the strange feeling that sometimes you're not entirely alone inside your own body. And if that idea ever becomes too easy to dismiss, just remember this. She went into surgery as one person and came out as something slightly different, something shared, something unknown. And maybe the most unsettling part of all this is not what changed, but the possibility that we don't yet fully understand what we are made of in the first place. Let's move on. Here's another unsettling story. It begins, like most stories do, with a life saved. A young girl. Her name is never consistently given in the versions of this account. In some retellings, she is identified. In others, she remains anonymous. And in most careful versions, she is simply referred to as a child recipient. What is consistent across the story is she was critically ill. Her heart was failing. And without a transplant, she would not survive. For her family, the waiting period is described as something almost suspended in time. Days measured, not by routine, but by uncertainty. Every phone call, every update from doctors, every quiet moment carrying the same unspoken fear that the next heartbeat might be the last one she ever produces on her own. And then, one day, a match is found. A donor heart becomes available. A child on the edge of life is given a second chance. The surgery is performed. Hours pass. Machines hum. Medical staff work in silence that only hospitals truly know. Then the kind where everything is urgent, but no one speaks above a whisper. And then, it works. The heart takes. The child survives. At first, everything follows the expected path of recovery. Weakness, gradual improvement, the slow rebuilding of a life that had nearly ended before it could have fully begun. Her family was extremely grateful. The doctors are cautious, but optimistic. It looks on the surface like a straightforward miracle of modern medicine. But then something begins to change. At first, it's small, almost dismissible. The child begins to talk about dreams. Not the normal dreams of a recovering child, shaped by hospital rooms and medications and fragmented sleep. These dreams are different. They feel vivid, specific. She begins describing things she has never seen before, places she has never been, moments that do not belong to her life. At first, her parents assume it's nothing unusual. The mind processing anesthesia, trauma, recovery. The strange hallucinations that can sometimes accompany long hospital stays. But the details begin to accumulate, and they begin to feel less random, more structured, more intentional. Then comes something even more difficult to explain. She begins speaking about a boy. A boy she insists that she knows. A boy who appears in her dreams repeatedly, not as a vague figure, but as someone that's distinct, someone real. Someone with a presence that feels to her completely familiar. She describes him in fragments at first. Clothing, feelings, impressions. But over time, the descriptions become more precise. Too precise. And then, she begins describing things that she should not know. Things that, according to the story, were later associated with the donor. At this point, the narrative shifts. Because the family requests information about the donor. Something many transplant families eventually seek in some form, even if only for closure. And that's what they were told. They told them that it's limited. The information's limited. It's protected by privacy laws and such. But the fragments they do learn begin to form a disturbing alignment. The donor child was a boy. And the circumstances of his death, never described in detail in official accounts, were traumatic. Violent enough that the family had chosen, understandably, to keep much of it private. But here's where the story takes its darkest turn, because the girl, the recipient, begins to describe dreams that mirror elements of the donor's life in ways that seem impossible for her to know. Not just preferences, but not just personality traits, but emotional fragments, sensations, fears. And in the most disturbing versions of the account, she begins expressing knowledge that feels connected to the moment of the donor's passing. Now, this is where the story becomes controversial, because there is no verified medical documentation confirming this level of detail transfer. There are no peer-reviewed studies supporting the idea that memory or trauma can be stored in transplanted organs. And yet, the story persists. It is repeated in forums, in anecdotal collections, in retellings that grow slightly more elaborate each time they are passed along. And always, at the center of it, the same unsettling question. Why would a child who never lived that life begin to dream it? Some doctors explain it through known psychological mechanisms. Suggestion, they say. Emotional projection. The brain attempting to construct meaning from a life-altering medical event. And those explanations are grounded. They are reasonable. And they are supported by science, but they do not always feel like they are close to this case emotionally. But there is something about transplant recovery, especially in young recipients, that already exists on the edge of identity. A body that is partially your own and partially not. A heartbeat that did not originate with you. A rhythm that continues, but has changed hands. As the story continues, the girl reportedly becomes more emotionally affected by the dreams. She reacts strongly to certain triggers, certain images, certain feelings that she cannot explain in her own words. And her family begins to notice something else, a growing sense that the emotional weight of these experiences is not fading. It's accumulating, as if something unresolved is pressing against the surface of her awareness. Not asking to be remembered, but refusing to be forgotten. Eventually, in some versions of the story, this leads to concern from medical professionals. Psychological evaluations are suggested. The standard explanations are explored. And still, no definitive answer emerges. Because there is no measurable way to separate memory from imagination in a case like this. No way to prove where dreams begin or where the feelings originate. And so the story settles into ambiguity, as these stories always do. But what makes this one endure is not the details themselves, it's the implication, the suggestion that something about the identity might not be entirely confined to the brain, that emotion, trauma, or experience might somehow leave a trace in the body itself, and that, when the body is transplanted, something else might cross with it, not fully formed, not conscious, but present, like a shadow of experience that refuses to dissolve completely. Today, most scientists would dismiss this entirely. They would point it to neuroscience, psychology, the known effects of trauma and recovery. And they would be correct to do so within those boundaries of what can be proven. But stories like this are not always about proof. They're about persistence. The way certain ideas refuse to disappear completely, even when science says they should. Because somewhere in the overlap between medicine and mystery, there remains a question that has never been fully answered. What happens to parts of us that cannot be measured? And if a heart can be moved from one body to another, is it possible that something less tangible might move with it? Or is this simply what it feels like when the mind tries to make sense of something it was never designed to understand? Either way, the story remains quiet, unverified, unresolved, and still told again and again, as if some part of us is not entirely ready to let it go. Now I want to step away from individual cases for a moment and look at the man who helped give this entire idea a kind of language, a framework, and for many people, a sense that these stories might mean something more than coincidence. His name was Paul Pearsall, and whether you agree with him or not, his work is one of the many reasons transplant personality transfer stories entered mainstream discussion instead of staying buried in medical anecdotes. Paul Pearsall was a neuropsychologist by training. He studied the brain, behavior, and emotion in a clinical academic context. So on paper, he was not someone expected to step into controversial territory. But later in his career, something shifted his focus. He became interested in something most of mainstream science avoided entirely: what transplant recipients were experiencing internally after receiving new organs. Not just physical recovery, but emotional change, identity shifts, and strange, persistent feelings that something inside them had altered in ways they couldn't fully articulate. In 1998, Pearsall published a book called The Heart's Code. This book would become the center of both fascination and criticism. Inside it, he collected interviews and personal accounts from heart transplant recipients. And what he reported hearing again and again was not just gratitude or survival stories, it was change. Recipients were describing things as sudden shifts in personality, new emotional sensitivities, unexpected food cravings, changes in preferences, habits, and reactions, and in some cases, a strong sense of knowing something about their donor. Pearsall didn't claim that memories were transferred like files from one brain to another. Instead, he proposed something more subtle, something more controversial, that the heart might carry with what he called emotional cellular memory. Not literal memory in the way that the brain stores information, but something like an imprint, like a biological echo of emotional experience, a kind of residue carried within living tissue. According to Pearsall, some transplant recipients described feeling different after surgery in ways that they couldn't explain, drawn to interests or traits that they later discovered matched their donors, emotionally influenced by feelings that seemed unfamiliar but yet were persistent. One of the most frequently cited patterns in Pearsall's collected interviews involved what we might call alignment moments. This is where a recipient experiences a change, and only later discovers it matches something about their donor. For example, a person who suddenly dislikes food that they once loved, later learning that the donor also disliked those foods. A recipient who develops new emotional traits, later finding those traits described in their donor, in their donor records or family accounts. A sudden personality shift that seems to fit the identity of the person whose heart was received. Now, critically, these are not controlled scientific findings. They are retrospective reports, human recollections, subjective experiences filtered through memory, emotion, and interpretation. But in Pearsall's view, the consistency of the patterns was what mattered, not proof, but repetition. Now, mainstream neuroscience and transplant medicine did not accept Pearsall's conclusions. The objections were strong and straightforward. They said that there is no known biological mechanism for memory storage in heart tissue. They said that personality and memory are functions of the brain only, not peripheral organs. Transplant patients undergo extreme psychological stress and medication effects that can alter a person's perception. They said that confirmation bias can strongly influence how donor information is interpreted after the fact. In other words, the experiences might be real to the patients, but the interpretation is not necessarily literal. Researchers instead pointed to post-surgical trauma, identity reconstruction after life-saving events, powerful suggestion effects once donor information is learned, and emotional bonding with the idea of survival itself. What made Paul Pearsall so controversial was not that he ignored science. It's that he tried to expand the conversation beyond what science could easily measure. He argued that even if memory is stored in the brain, emotion might not be so neatly contained. And if the heart is deeply involved in emotional regulation, which modern psychology does acknowledge to some extent that perhaps transplant experience deserve more attention than dismissal? Not as proof of memory transfer, but as unexplained human experience. What Pearsall ultimately contributed to the entire field of discussion is not certainty, it's ambiguity. He placed transplant stories into a space where three interpretations now overlap. Number one, strict scientific explanation, biology, psychology, or medicine. Two, psychological meaning making, identity reconstruction, trauma response. And number three, symbolic or philosophical interpretation, the heart as emotional center of identity. And depending on where you stand, the same story can feel completely different. A coincidence, some say, a psychological adaptation, or something that suggests a deeper unknown. What makes Pearsall's work endure is not that it proves anything. It's that it asked a question most science prefers to avoid. What if subjective experience matters as much as measurable data when trying to understand consciousness? Because transplant patients are not just biological systems being repaired. They are people reporting lived experiences inside bodies that no longer feel entirely familiar. And whether you interpret that as psychology or mystery or something in between, the question remains open. What changes when a human heart is replaced? And what, if anything, might it carry with it? That is the space where Paul Pearsall built his work. Not in certainty, but in the uncomfortable silence between explanation and experience. And for many people, that silence is exactly where the story begins. I'm Kyle Filson, and this is Expanded Perspectives.
Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts.
episode of Expanded Perspectives is brought to you by IQ Bar.
Aw, yeah.
Our exclusive snack and hydration sponsor. Look, life is hectic, especially now when the NHL playoffs are about to start. Baseball's about to start. Between watching your favorite team, work, family, or recording in the studio, everything else is pulling at you, and it's easy to forget to eat right or get the protein your body actually needs. And that's where IQ Bar comes in. Before I head out for the day, whether I'm going to work, going to a Stars game, going to the studio, or sitting in just a hunting blind, I always toss a couple IQ bars and a few hydration packs in my bag. It's quick, it's easy, and I know that I'm fueling my body the right way. IQ Bar is the better for you plant protein snack made with brain boosting nutrients designed to refuel, nourish, and satisfy your hunger without that brutal sugar crash later on. IQ Bar products are completely free of gluten, dairy, soy, GMOs, and artificial sweeteners, making them a clean, natural snack for you to reach to anytime you get hungry. I suggest trying their ultimate sampler pack. That's the perfect place to start. In that pack, you'll get 9 IQ Bar protein bars, you'll get 8 IQ Mix hydration sticks, and you'll get 4 IQ Joe mushroom coffee sticks. It's amazing. Some of my favorites include salted caramel chip, wild blueberry, banana nut, chocolate sea salt. My favorite hydration pack is the Arnold Palmer, but I also like peach mango, and I also dig the passion fruit. And the coffees, they have toasted hazelnut, cafe mocha, vanilla spice, or just original black. Cam, you love it. You try it. Your wife likes the mushroom coffees. You like the snacks. I like the hydration packs.
Yeah.
Tell everybody where they can get
theirs. Dude, I love the snack bars. It's the one thing, I don't ever get the coffees. My wife takes those away from me. And right now, IQ Bar is offering y'all, all of y'all listening, our listeners, 20% off of all products, y'all. 20% off all products plus free shipping. All you got to do is text the word expanded to 64,000. That's EXPANDED to 64,000. It's that easy, folks. That simple. For 20% off all products plus free shipping, message and data rates may apply. See terms for details. Y'all, fuel your brain, fuel your body, and start your day the smarter way with IQ Bar.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Strange phenomenon.
Right? Yeah.
Strange things happen. And science really can't explain.
Science! They blinded me with science.
Yeah, science can't explain what these people are experiencing. But that's weird, right? Like people, they never craved beer. They didn't crave hot dogs and all this stuff. And then they get an organ transplant and all of a sudden that's like their thing, man. I really want hot dogs. I really want to drink beer all the time. And it turns out,
was it your organ that they took?
Right. Yeah. It was, but that's what the previous owner enjoyed.
Yeah.
I've read accounts where people like with sports, like this one person was just like an old grandmother, right? She like was into gardening, sewing, quilting.
She had a
stuff like, no, listen. She received an organ. And next thing you know, she's like obsessed with NASCAR. And the
put her behind the wheel.
You can drive it, but you like don't know watching
that.
It.
You don't know that.
I think the average NASCAR fan would be terrible at driving.
But you don't know till you know.
Yeah, I think they have.
That's why we've always talked about if you have a championship anything, you need to put just some regular dudes out there so the regular dudes at home that think they can do it understand they can't.
It's a good call.
Right, like we've talked about, like hockey. You need to get a bunch of just
fighting
regular
is the
dudes.
Worst. Is the absolute worst. For whatever reason, all men think they can fight.
Yeah.
When literally about 2% of you actually can. It is mind blowing. Just go up the north side on any weekend
and watch.
Go down the 6th Street or anywhere you want. You'll see countless men engaging in
peacocking and posturing fights. Around.
You could end up in prison. You could kill somebody accidentally over nothing.
What was it that Jared Kessel went in a line from, was it Letterkenny, that said if you ever been in a real fight, you wouldn't be so keen to get another one?
That's 100% accurate.
You're like, well, that's a lot of
what it is, right?
I don't want no part of it.
I mean, I probably follow 10 different Instagram accounts where it's just nothing but people street fighting.
Do you still laugh? Like,
oh,
as
every
hard
time.
Today as you do?
Because it's like, you see these guys getting into it, and it's clear they don't know what they're doing, right? The best is when it's somebody that picks on somebody, you're like, ooh, that guy looks like he knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
And then it usually doesn't last long.
Well, no, because then you get detached from consciousness, and you're not getting that good sleep. Like, you're sleeping because you've been turned off.
Oh, and I've seen guys just turn the lights out on other people, and then like the guy's girlfriend tries to assault the guy that just turned the lights out on her man. You're like, what are you doing?
Are those equal opportunity hands? Because I've seen that happen too.
It's sad though, but he's just like, what are y'all doing?
Yeah.
Stop. Delusion.
You know what you learn as you get older? You're like, I don't want no part of that. That could be life changing. If I fell down now, I'd be like, man, I think I broke something.
Dude, my foot hurt for a week after helping Step tear that awning down.
Standing on the side of the caved in rooftop.
What am I doing?
I've got something I want to share with you.
Yeah.
This comes from near Brandon, Florida. So we got to holler out down there to Andrew and Andy and Hooper, right? We're going to have to
sure,
check
yeah.
on them. They may have something to do with this. I don't know. But when I read this to you, you're going to be like, what? Starts out saying, when I was younger, I had an encounter with some kind of creature that I still cannot explain. This happened in Pasco County, Florida, near Brandon. Now, I've tried to make sense of it over the years, but I still don't know what this was. Now, the closest comparison that I can give is that it looked somewhat like one of those old troll dolls they used to make. But there was nothing harmless or amusing about it. The feeling it gave me was far darker. It was more like that of a troll or a demonic being.
Mm.
I was getting ready to go out to dinner or somewhere with my family. My parents had already walked out of the house and into the garage, and so I'd gone back into my room to grab something, and when I turned around, this thing standing in the doorway. It was about 5 foot tall, not extremely tall, but not particularly short either. It just stood there for a few seconds, smiling at me. Now, I remember the expression very clearly. Its lips seemed to cover its teeth, so it wasn't snarling or showing them. It was more like a strange grin. And that somehow made it even more disturbing. It had big round eyes that stared directly at me, and for those few seconds, I was completely frozen. The face is what has stayed with me the most. I remember its nostrils fluttering slightly, which made it feel physically alive. I would not describe it as reptilian. Its skin had a flesh-colored tone, kind of tan, almost, again, like the old troll dolls, but still close enough to normal skin color to make it even more unsettling. This thing looked totally bizarre, but it was real.
Mm.
I looked away for a second. When I quickly looked back, this thing's gone. Now, at that time, I had no idea what to do. I was just terrified, but I never told my parents. Even then, I felt like nobody would believe me if I said I'd just seen some strange creature standing in my doorway smiling. I knew how people react to stories like that, so I just kept it to myself. Now nothing like that has ever happened again. Never happened to me, nothing. But that moment has stayed with me ever since. It only lasted a few seconds, but it was one of the most frightening experiences of my life, Thomas. So, a five-foot troll in there. Again, that story, the reason I like it is because it feels like they're possibly always there.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
See it. You just happen to be like, oh, it sees me. And then he's like, oh, it sees me. Now the troll's got to bounce.
The trolls or the machine elves.
Exactly.
They're always there in the background
always
stuff, right?
Always hiding out.
I've got another Glimmer Man sighting.
Oh, lay it on me.
It says, I'm a native of Schuylkill County. I guess that's how you say it. Maybe Schuylkill County, Pennsylvania. I don't know the private hunting club where this happened like the back of my hand.
All right.
I'd been roaming these grounds since I was about 10 years old, so I'm familiar with the terrain, the trees, the game trails, and the usual sounds and movements in that area. This took place during the hunting season in November 2021. It was warmer than usual, and I had remained at my original spot until after lunch. Since deer activity was slow, I decided to get up and move around a little to see if I could stir something up. As I walked, I came upon an area beneath a tree where several limbs had been pushed down and pinned in place with other branches. The more I looked, the more I noticed what appeared to be an additional stick structures nearby. I took photos of the top of the first tree with my phone, and from what I could tell, there was nothing visible in it. Near that same spot, I also noticed what looked like deer scrapes on the ground. Now that got my attention. Instead of moving on, I backed off about 30 yards and positioned myself behind another tree where I'd gotten a good view of the area. I stood there watching for around 30 minutes. Then I noticed a branch move in that same fir tree. A few minutes later, the next lower branch moved, then another. Then the lower branches moved in succession, one after another, as if something was climbing down the tree, using the limbs like steps on a ladder. Whatever was doing it would have had to have been fairly large, or at least long enough to reach, to descend that way. The strange thing was that I never saw an actual creature.
Uh-oh.
I saw the limbs move, I saw the motion continue downward in sequence, but I didn't see anything. I watched the branches react as though weight had been being placed on them, but I could not see any solid form, animal, or person attached to that movement. When the lowest branch moved, I heard a heavy, solid thud hit the ground. Then everything stopped. No crashing through the brush, no deer running off, no bird flushing, nothing. Just absolute silence. I figured whatever it was had known I was there because I had been standing directly under that tree earlier for at least 20 minutes. Still, it did not come at me or make any further moves. I had my .308 with me, so I was not defenseless. And I also trusted my instincts enough to remain where I was. I stayed until after sunset. When I finally walked back to my vehicle, I kept turning around, half expecting something to reveal itself or suddenly uncloak. Nothing ever did. I should also mention that there was no putrid smell at all. The woods smelled normal. No foul odor, no rotting scent, nothing to suggest a bear or some other large animal was close by. I still cannot say for sure what it was, but I know that I watched something come down out of that tree, and I never saw what made the branches move, Brandon.
See, that's cool.
So this one was completely cloaked. An invisible something crawled down out of that tree. But, I mean, he doesn't know what it was. Like, again, is that a ghost? Is it a figment of his imagination?
I don't.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
What was it? He's not claiming, by the way, that this was a Glimmer Man. He just said he sounds like a Glimmer Man.
He just saw something that he couldn't see.
Yeah. I don't know. If you have any strange stories about Glimmer Man or anything else you'd like to share with Cam and I and the rest of the listeners, you can email the show expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can call our hotline 888-393-2783. If you want to support the show and you want more Expanded Perspectives, just go to Expanded Perspectives Elite. You have to go to Patreon to do that.
Patreon.
That's right. Patreon. That's the name of your next dog, right?
That's 100% right. It's going to be my French. He's going to be named Patreon.
And if you want a copy of the Glimmer Man book, you can go to Amazon. You can get it there. Or if you want a signed copy, message Cam and I. And when we get those from the publisher, we will ship those anywhere in North America. I think I'm going to limit it to that. I mean, if you're willing to pay to have it shipped to Zimbabwe, I mean, I'm all for it.
Send it wherever.
I'm not going to be paying for the shipping.
It's going to be, because that's,
it gets costly. That could be astronomical.
Yeah. It's costly. If I got to go duck that, I'm going to deliver it. That way I can hunt wherever I'm going.
You got any big plans this weekend?
Shooting pigs, trying to shoot some turkey. Went and hung out the other day with our buddy Chris.
Yeah.
Down there, we shot a bunch of Umarex air rifles, watched them kill some turkey. He shot some more today, I think. So, yeah, that's pretty much it. That's pretty much the whole thing. Going to go, my son's having a crawfish cooking coming, so I'm going to go eat over there with dad, hang out with the granddaughter.
I thought he already did that.
He did.
He's doing another one.
Yeah. Oh. It was my nephew did the last one that we went to.
I got it.
This is the boy. He's going to do this one. Mr. Massive Head Wound Harry, he's going to take care of this one for us.
I'm going to be taking care of Pop-Pop. And so that's going to be taking up most of my time. I think Luke and Dalee are going to a movie. They're going to go see the new Faces of Death tonight.
Shocker.
I didn't even know they were remaking that.
Because we didn't realize it was fake back then. It's fake now. It's just the whole thing.
Well, that's what I was trying to pick his brain. I was like, you do know what it is, right? And he was like, no, not really. I go, it's just like a collection of crazy killings.
Yeah, I remember thinking it was so real as kids, right?
When absolutely.
You always heard about it. And we still make the jokes about it to this day.
Like the Gatorama?
The Gatorama stuff.
Look what they've done to him.
Oh, it's got him! And you just see the gator and all. Yeah, it was that whole thing. So, yeah. Looking back now, knowing as an adult, you look at it and be like, yeah, you could tell it's totally a joke. But, boy, they had me.
I used to like the one, I'm trying to remember if it was Faces of Death or it was another one similar to that, where the guy had built this giant ramp, like in Michigan, and he was going to try to jump his jet powered car over this giant river.
Sounds awesome.
Well, of course, it didn't work out.
Was it? Oh, wait, I remember which was the Snake River jump, wasn't it?
Maybe. I don't remember.
Is that the one? Yeah, I think that's what it is.
This was early 80s, dude.
Yeah. Yeah. And the dude didn't make it.
The crazy thing is, I remember my father renting Faces of Death on more than one occasion.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I could watch any of that stuff, but I couldn't go into that room that had the black curtain pulled over it in case you might see some female breasts or something on the cover of one of those, right? But if it come down to killing, like people getting, folks is cool with it. Like, yeah, it's no big deal.
Right.
Think of the movies we watched as kids.
Okay. So
that may have shaped a lot of it. Okay. We're talking about being 10 years old and you're like, y'all want to watch Full Metal Jacket? You're like, heck yeah, I do.
So I watched a movie for the first time in a long time. I hadn't seen since the 80s.
Okay. What is it?
It was on Tubi TV. I wasn't saying I was watching. It was kind of like on in the background while I was doing something
else. Sure. Okay. Go ahead. It was,
of course, Chuck Norris.
Yes.
Invasion USA.
Oh, yeah. What's the enemy, the bad guy's name? Klaus. Come on. What is his name? Because he's been in a bunch of stuff, too.
Oh, yeah. He's been in
a bunch. Is that where he shoot a laws tube or something at a bus?
Okay. So this is what I was going to tell you. I don't know.
It's going to be terrible.
I don't know who the armorer was or who was the director.
Did they even have them back then on a set?
But I don't know what kind of Bolivian marching powder made them decide to do this. But there's more laws rockets in that movie than I've ever seen. Without exaggeration.
Don't be hating.
28 to 35 Laws rockets are used. I'm like, where are they getting them, first of all?
So do you think that had an influence when we were building them out of PVC to shoot bottle rockets?
100%.
Yes.
100%.
Now I got to go back and watch it. It's on Tubi?
Yeah.
Invasion USA.
Remember, he's got a special sling he's got with two like Uzis that he could do this.
Yes, but
you got to put it on. Two shoulder straps.
Man, the 80s were such a corny time for movies because everybody thought they were ninjas and flying through the air and throwing kicks and tough guys. And then you go back and watch it, like knowing what you know about military stuff today. And then you go back and watch movies from the 80s. You're just like, was somebody just making it up? Somebody, one of those stolen valor guys were just pretending that they'd been in the military.
Oh, you mean like Frank Dukes?
Look, I didn't say it. I mean, somebody that was a good, in air quotes, writer that put this in there. You're like, none of this happens. But you know what the good thing about Invasion USA was? Chuck's wearing those century stretch pants. You can see it when he starts throwing kicks. You can see the little stretched area down there between his legs. So, he's repping his stuff.
I wanted to order one of those out of Black Belt magazine as a pants. Kid, but my mom wouldn't pay for it.
I wanted a ninja outfit. And then I always said, when I get old enough, I'm going to have an all black. I'm talking with the tabby boots and like the whole thing, right? The ninja. And then I wanted one in the woodland camo that they had. And just so you know, I've got the money now. I ain't buying it.
I had those bear claws and I tried to climb up a cedar tree.
Yeah. Right? They don't work worth a damn. No. Those things are terrible. And always one of those things you could throw down and make smoke and disappear.
Well, and they would sell you throwing stars or shurikens, but they wouldn't be very sharp. But of course, I would go to the shop and get the grinder and make those things like razors.
Remember, I had built at my house, we had that big, we made the big target out of plywood.
Yeah.
And we had stacks of them, look like decks of cards with nothing but throwing stars. I'm going to have to get you some more of those. Your birthday's coming up. I'm going to get you some throwing stars.
I want a set of commas.
Okay. All right.
You know what I'm talking about?
I'm going to make you a set.
Oh, man. Well, that's about all the time we have for this episode, folks. I hope everybody out there has a good week. Till next time, I'm Kyle. He's Kim.
Peace, y'all.
Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts.